From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, Super Soldiers Saving the Earth from Aliens, Rescuing a President's Daughter from Evil Zombies. No, they're not from Hollywood. They are plot lines from the world of video games. Some 90 million young Americans belong to the gamer generation, the ones who grew up with a joystick in their hands. If you want to understand your young employees and the country's future, says our guest tonight, you may have to start playing more Mortal Kombat and Final Fantasy. Tonight on Point, the video game generation, revolutionizing life and work as we know it. But first tonight, time to break out the Tang. Just hours ago, the European space probe Huygens sent back the first ever pictures of Saturn's biggest moon, Titan. The journey took 7 years, and early indications are it was worth the wait. Scientists hope their new data from Titan will shed light on the origins of life here on Earth. Guy Gugliotta is space correspondent for The Washington Post. He was at the European Space Agency's Mission Control in Darmstadt, Germany, as the first images came in. I asked him what we'd learned from the pictures so far.
Well, we've learned that we have a successful mission. The probe dropped through the smoggy atmosphere. All the instruments were working, and we have just seen the first couple of images. One of a slushy, glacier-like mass, almost like wet cement in the truck. The second looks like gravel and stones, sort of like some of the Mars pictures we've seen over the past year from the Mars rovers.
Guy, how are the scientists there in Europe interpreting these first images? By now, millions around the world have seen them. What do the scientists make of them?
Well, I think it's probably a little too early to give a detailed analysis, but I think what has got them extremely excited is the fact that they believe that, particularly with the first photograph, that Titan has a dynamic surface. That is to say, it's geologically active. There's things going on. It's not still like the moon. It's not still like Mars. It has some sort of activity. Something is going on, and it's brand new, and they're just beginning to try to make something out of it.
Now, what's the program going to be for Huygens as it goes forward? You'll have Cassini coming by periodically. How does it work?
Huygens is dead. What happened was that it was a passive instrument. In other words, it was fired out of Cassini almost like a cannon shell, and aimed at Titan, got into the atmosphere, came down in a series of pre-programmed parachute drops, and then operated on its batteries for as long as it could before the battery died, maximum 7 hours. Huygens is an orphan, still and cold, on the surface of Titan and will be there probably for eternity.
So this is a one-time shot, and how long will scientists be interpreting that 7 hours of data collection?
From what they tell me, months and years. This is historic data. It is the first and probably the only data set that humans are going to see from Titan for an extremely long time.
Now, this whole effort with Cassini, that is NASA and the European Space Agency and Huygens, is designed to investigate the Earth's origins. What's the relationship between the moon of Saturn, Titan, and the Earth's origins?
Well, the scientists feel that Titan, even though it's 900 million miles away, is what they call a prebiotic version of the Earth. That is, may have looked, probably did look something like Earth before life evolved. It's got a largely nitrogen atmosphere, same as we do. It's got huge reservoirs of hydrocarbons, the building blocks of life, carbon compounds like methane and ethane. And it is the only known moon in the solar system with an atmosphere. What makes it prebiotic rather than biotic is that it is so far distant from the sun that it's extremely cold. And so it's been in a deep freeze for billions of years, offering scientists a perfect opportunity, perhaps, to see what the Earth looked like long, long ago before anything was living.
Now, were the scientists there able to tell from the way that Huygens landed what the surface of Titan, the moon, is like? Was it a thump or a splash or a squish?
They're going for thump right now. The right up until the very end, know if it would be thump, splash, or scrunch, whether it would be liquid, slushy, or solid. But their guess now is that it was a solid landing because the probe lasted for so long after it landed. The feeling was that the probe, since it wasn't watertight or it wasn't liquid tight, if it landed in an ethane lake or a pond, would probably live only for a few minutes before the liquid invaded the capsule and killed it. Instead, the probe landed and the temperature was about a comfortable 75 degrees Fahrenheit inside for several hours. This means that it was kept dry. And if it was kept dry, that meant that it almost for sure landed on hard, solid ground.
An incredible day, 350 years since the Dutch astronomer Christiaan Huygens discovered the moon Titan. I'm sure he would not have imagined that the instruments of humans would be landing there.
Well, it's quite true. It is quite a day. People are quite happy here.
Guy Gugliotta, thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Guy Gugliotta, space correspondent for the Washington Post. He spoke with me from the European Space Agency's Mission Control in Darmstadt, Germany. The virtual world of video games is big, bold, often bloody, and the business of video games is booming. Last year alone, game sales topped $10 billion. Bigger than book sales, bigger than Hollywood. Chances are you or someone you know is a gamer, maybe on the Xbox or PlayStation or computer right now, leading a gangland war in Grand Theft Auto, destroying alien invaders in Half-Life 2, or creating entire societies in The Sims. Millions of baby boomers, many of them parents, look on and think young gamers are rotting their minds, wasting their time. Not so, says our guest tonight. The gamer generation, he says, is honing a unique set of skills that are taking the American workplace by storm. They are game ready to be a new breed of leaders, heroes, innovators, risk takers. A generation of video game entertainment, he says, has shaped revolutionary new employees, executives, and entrepreneurs. Tonight on Point, reassessing the gamer generation. You can join the conversation. Is it just possible that all those hours at the PlayStation are creating a generation of big winners? Do you buy it? Are you part of it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is John Beck, Senior Research Fellow at the Annenberg Center of the Digital Future at the University of Southern California. He is co-author, along with Mitchell Wade, of the new book, Got Game? How the Gamer Generation is Reshaping Business Forever. John Beck, good to have you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be here.
So wait a minute. This is, I know it sells books to go off message, but the big message, and I'm sure you hear it every time you raise your head above the ramparts these days. Come on. The kids are down in the basement with the Xbox, and they're rotting their brains, as I think you guys may put it. And you say not so. What's the evidence?
We were surprised, actually, by the evidence. We went out and did a survey of 2,500 Americans, professionals, age 20 and up, and asked them, the important variable was, did you play games growing up or not?
And a whole lot of them must have at this point. I mean, what percentage?
It broke down to about... Almost 50-60% said okay. They grew up playing games.
Mm-hmm.
But depending on what age they were, you get very different kinds of percentages.
You mean if they were playing them sort of while they were still on the pacifier, it's different than they didn't do it until they were teenagers.
Well, if you're over 35 years old, only about 30% reported that they played them growing up. So they were going to arcades, playing early Atari.
Oh, I see. So the 20-somethings more likely than the 30-somethings to have been deep in that pond.
Right. And some 40-somethings respond that they did play video games growing up, but they were doing it in a very different way than the 15-year-olds today are doing it.
You make some pretty enormous claims out of this. You say you went in with your own skepticism. You said you thought you would find high technical skills,
right,
interesting ways of using those skills, but on the other side, real gaps in teamwork, leadership, work ethic. And you say that the data out of your study proved you all wrong. I'm quoting you guys here. Professionals who grew up playing video games actually make better business people. They're more serious about achievement, more attached to the company they work for and the people they work with, more flexible, persistent, problem solvers, more willing to take Only risks that make sense. In short, they're pretty good executives right out of the gate, not at all what boomers would expect. So they go off to the Xbox and they come back, what, perfect something or other?
Well, it's very good CEO training, it appears, or at least it tends that way. Now, all of this is statistical, so you're not talking night and day differences, but you're talking anywhere between 5 and 20% changes across those kinds of questions on the survey.
So, you mean in who's a better team player and who's more a reasoned risk taker,
right,
and who's more persistent, persevering?
Right.
So, but you've got a statistical advantage that's significant. You found it,
yes,
among those players. What do you chalk this up to?
I think it's the way that playing games during a certain period of life actually changes the way the brain works.
Neural pathways.
So between the ages of 5 and 15 are when both most boys and girls play the most games. That also happens to be the period when the neural pathways are basically formed in the brain. You can learn a new language before about age 15 without having to connect it to another language. After 15, you have to do the synapse connection between this word in French means this word in English. Before that, you don't. So this is a period that's very formative for the brain, and these kids are playing, in many cases, as much games as they are going to school.
Okay, I'm going to keep coming at this from the boomer perspective for a moment.
So
they're down there with the games, and here's what's going on. As their neural pathways are being formed, I'm looking at, just a selection of big games right now. Halo 2, warrior fighting an insurrection. Intense violence primarily consists of shooting and killing aliens. Graphic descriptions of players' death. So that's on the neural pathways. Doom 3, Marine fights his way through zombies and monsters on Mars. Grand Theft Auto, former gang member shoots and steals his way through problems. Gangsters kill cops and steal cars. Gangsters solicit prostitutes and then beat them. Okay, so what's being laid down in the neural pathways?
Well, to the extent that 5 to 15-year-olds are kind of playing those games, that would be laid down in certain ways. But that's not really – usually that age group is playing a very different kind of game. They're playing Mario. They're playing Final Fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much more benign kind of game that group is playing. But there are some things that it doesn't matter whether they're playing the violent games or the nonviolent games that are characteristics of games that all of them are getting. For instance, learning by doing. Trial and error.
Learning by doing. Let's just sit on that one for a moment. I guess boomers would say, what do you mean doing? They're sitting downstairs in a dark room in the pale blue glow of the video screen.
Right.
But you're saying, in fact, in terms of developing patterns of thinking, they're doing. They're in the game doing.
They're doing it. They're not reading it. 10% of what you read, you retain.
Mm-hmm.
30% of what you hear, you retain. Great to be in radio.
Mm-hmm.
70% of what you do, you retain.
And they're virtually doing it.
They're virtually doing it.
As much as doing it,
absolutely.
You say.
When they're sitting there playing those games, when they're walking down that hall and a ball of flame comes out of the floor, that's a very different kind of even game experience than I had growing up playing basketball. Balls of flame never came out of the floor when I was playing basketball growing up.
Great balls of fire.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more we want to learn here, but you're saying boomers or non-gamers, be careful about sneering at this, because this generation is coming up like gangbusters, and they're going to eat your lunch.
They're about 120 million strong right now in the U.S. And in the workforce, they are the next generation of managers in the workforce. But in many cases, the boomer managers don't know what to do with this young generation. They can't figure out how their minds work. They're confused. In fact, we were all confused by the dot-com boom, which was basically that generation playing by a set of new rules that none of the rest of us understood, and we called them new rules, but they all seemed to understand it. Well, they grew up playing video games. Of course they understood it.
All right, we're going to get a master class tonight. We're talking about the video game generation and a new celebration of its game-generated life skills. You can join the conversation. Is it just possible that all those hours at the PlayStation are creating a generation of big winners? Gamers, have you come out of Super Mario, Zelda, and Grand Theft Auto ready to take on the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-OUCH. Talk. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Lead on, Freeman.
You have chosen or been chosen.
Rated M for mature.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the video game generation and a new celebration of its game-generated life skills. My guest is John Beck, co-author of the new book, Got Game, How the Gamer Generation is Reshaping Business Forever. You can join the conversation tonight. Boomers, are you ready to admit that video games may not have rotted your kids' minds but sharpened them? And do we believe that video games create model citizens, maybe a new model, innovative, risk-taking, reward-seeking, persevering gamers, non-gamers? Let us know what you think. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. For Americans who grew up playing digital solitaire or Pong, today's electronic games look more like elaborate movies than the old desktop computer games. Video games have taken giant leaps in style, complexity, and technical sophistication. From the days of Pac-Man to today's Doom 3, you wouldn't believe the difference.
Back on the block, huh? Yeah, it's good to see you back.
Your death is coming.
Soundtracks there from video games past and present, from Space Invaders and Donkey Kong to Half-Life 2 and Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. John Beck, you must have played a lot of these by now doing your research. But you say that the gamer generation literally thinks differently, that they're really not wired the way we, I'm not sure what that means, but the way we are, that they see the world differently. Give us the cause, give us the effect. What's going on? What's the different wiring?
Well, the we basically is my co-author and I, who are both boomers.
Okay.
And we didn't expect to find much good going on out there, really, but we thought there might be some kind of an effect on business. So we went into and looked at it, and, you know, these kids who are growing up really just end up thinking very differently based on these studies. We found statistical significance after statistical significance between business attitudes and the question, did you grow up playing video games?
And walk us through the characteristics that you see games having heightened, and give us a sense of why as you roll them out to us.
Yeah, well, some things you'd naturally expect. Competitiveness. You know, this is a group that responds, they like to compete more than the non-gamers.
More than, I don't know, guys who played pickup basketball.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's what the survey would suggest.
Okay.
Well, you get weird things going on. Let me just give you an example of the competitiveness that happens. We've got a great story of about a 10-year-old girl playing The Sims.
Sure.
Not exactly a competitive game, you would think.
Building a city or building a culture or society.
Building families, basically.
Okay.
It's that Sims.
Mm-hmm.
And she built this one family she just absolutely adored. You know, parents, couple of kids, a dog. They were a great family. But
that's competitive, it sounds?
No, they couldn't live in the house she wanted them to live in. They didn't have enough money, but she loved this family.
She had to go to battle for them
digitally.
She
had an idea, and it was a devious plot. She created another family that was not a nice family,
mm-hmm.
but they were very good at getting money and then spending it, and she took them into deep debt, getting this beautiful house built for them.
Okay.
And once they got so much in debt that they had to declare bankruptcy,
yeah.
she was able to buy at fire sale prices
and her clan moved
the
in.
House that that family was in, and her family moved in.
So not only competitive, but what are those, scenario trained to compete in very complex
strategic ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think about thinking through that process at the age of 10.
So competitive. What else have you got?
Risk-taking. They take risks. They take calculated risks. They think about risk in a very different way, in a much more complex way.
Why?
Because they're taking risks all the time. They're taking risks
and
basically
why calculated risks? Because if they, in the games, train them that if they're not careful, they fall off the cliff, they're done.
To think two or three steps ahead. So
mm-hmm.
they're very good at playing basically a big game of electronic chess
mm-hmm.
at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
They're you know, their buying spending patterns and how they think about doing that is very different. You'd kind of expect that. You know, electronics is what they spend on. They spend a lot on
it.
Those kinds of things. Some of the things that you wouldn't expect are, it turned out that they were, to the question, I really care about the fate of the organization I work for, and I'm committed to the organization I work for.
What organization? They're playing themselves alone in a room or with one other person or two?
Now, this was a survey of 20-year-olds and up, so most of them were working. So the question is, are you committed to the company you work for? They turn out to be more committed.
Why would that be?
It's a really strange one, but I think it comes from the fact that they grew up in a world of internet and games, which is a world that interacts with them directly all the time. There are entities that they interact with online and in games that care about them and that they give input into. It's a far cry from me going into Sears when I was 10 years old. And I'll tell you, the sales clerk could care less that I was in Sears then.
Mm-hmm. And perseverance you've got, you're giving them that, leadership qualities. They even want to be heroes. They want to save the world. I guess that makes sense. All these games are about saving some glorious...
They're the center of the story. And they're saving something. They're doing something really good.
Does that make them good employees or narcissists?
A little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
They have pretty high self-opinion of themselves. To the question, are you an expert in your field? The gamer generation, who again is like 35 and younger for the most part, and ended up answering they thought of themselves more as experts than the older folks. In the survey. That's a little bit odd.
We had an hour just about a week ago now on 20-somethings who hadn't left home yet. We were thinking, what do we call this generation? We had a caller who said, I would call them the reset generation, very much a kind of digital video game computer term, which seems to link to perseverance. I mean, all these games, you get on one path, it doesn't work out, no biggie, you backtrack and start again.
Right.
You're saying that's the kind of people being produced here.
That is the kind. They certainly are the reset generation in many ways. You always can press the reset button and start over. So you try some of the most creative and interesting and weird things. You're not living a safe life in the video game.
So all in all, America moving into the hands of the gamer generation, and you say... Bravo, the games have created good stewards here.
Absolutely.
John Beck, stand by. I want to welcome to our conversation from San Francisco, Chris Anderson. He's editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine. Chris, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
So there you are. You're out in the middle of all this digital stuff. You must have plenty of staffers, and certainly you work in the midst, and maybe even yourself, gamers. Do you buy it? Do you see this sort of new super generation having been weaned on video games?
Well, I buy most of it. I am a gamer, although I'm slightly older than that generation.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it as a huge cultural force. It is definitely a demographic and generational thing. I mean, we find among our readers that basically if they're kind of, you know, over 40 or maybe 30, mid-30s, they find games to be sort of, you know, kid stuff and not for them, and sometimes even a little threatening as kind of, you know, an alien culture that they're not familiar with. And if they're younger than that, games are a big part of their life, and they pretty much, you know, test us as to, you know, whether we get games the same way they get games. So it's kind of polarizing for our audience.
But do you see their gaming mentality emerging in the way they work, the way they interact, the way they set goals and pursue them?
Well, no, I haven't read the book, so I'm not sure about that. I would say that it's a big cultural influence, which is to say that the language and the characters and the words from gaming is a big part of their life, and so they're kind of culturally engaged the way, you know, maybe my generation was culturally engaged in hip hop or punk rock or whatever age you are. It was a big force on them.
So here's the new rock and roll.
Exactly. Well, I think so, and you know, more so than television. And that's the one big difference we're seeing, is that this generation is used to interacting with their media.
And John Beck, I think he would take that further to say it's not just the language, it's not just the characters, whether it's Mario or Zelda, whoever it may be, that the whole format act of gaming has become the metaphor for life in the world for this generation. It's the metaphor through which they understand the world around them.
I don't know about that. I would say that the act of interacting with screens in every form, and that's why they're frustrated with television, because they can't interact with television. Mm-hmm. They're used to interacting with their media. They're used to having a kind of an active relationship with their entertainment. That does define the way they work. Now, I don't know what the application of that is, you know, to the workplace exactly. Obviously we. You know, we use computers, so they're interacting with that all the time.
In John Beck's view, that's kind of that's just kind of where it begins. John, you take it all the way up to a very high level. You say, in fact, if I read you right, that this gaming generation is more likely to see a kind of ordered universe where ultimately, if you play the game hard and right and persistently, things work out for you.
Well, we do. We make the argument that basically game designers who design the games that these kids are playing, design a game that people can win in, always. They can always succeed. So it's a very benevolent game designer. Now, if you take that and take it to a more metaphysical level, maybe the game designer, capital G, mm-hmm. capital D,
Lord Almighty,
becomes very benevolent in their minds. I mean, we actually have evidence that that's going on.
And a kind of faith that comes out of I want to begin to get our callers in. A lot of them have been waiting. Darren's calling from Norton, Massachusetts. Hi, Darren. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing? I just wanted to say that, you know, I've been playing video games for a long time, and I've seen a lot of benefits from playing video games. First off, there's a lot to do with hand-eye coordination, obviously. There's been studies that show that, you know, surgeons and fighter pilots and et cetera have really benefited from.
Right, we know that one. What about these bigger claims? What else do you see, Darren?
I see that there's an increase in creativity among kids that play video games.
Now, why? Why do you think that's true? I mean, the game's already built for you. It's not like you're creating the game.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you see a lot of the video games, like, you look at a game like Elder Scrolls Morrowind, which is a game, or RPGs like that, which is where you, there's a lot of thinking involved, where you have to make your own decision. It's like a Dungeons & Dragons kind of thing sometimes.
Do you notice within your social set, can you tell, just by talking, who's a gamer and who's not?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That kind of stuff, it comes up a lot in everyday conversation.
But, I mean, even if you're not talking about the game, can you tell by the way people think or interact or, I don't know, twitch their thumbs?
Every once in a while you'll get someone that's just obviously a gamer by just an attitude they have. It's a certain discernible quality that sometimes you can see.
And what do you think your avid gamesmanship has got you set up to do in life, in this world, Darren?
Well, I don't think it'll really affect my worldview, what I'll do in the future. But
will it affect the way you do whatever it is?
Well, you know, that's a tough question. I think it actually might, but I'm not really sure.
Well, you're going to find out, and I guess guys like John Beck will be watching. Darren, thank you very much for your call. John, there's your target, and he says, yeah, this is defining my life in many ways.
Yeah, and we find that over and over again in talking to people, and we find it even among baby boomers who kind of get it. They look at it and say, you know, this younger generation, once we start hearing about games as possibly being the reason that they're different, we kind of get it and we start to understand it. And that's been one of the useful points of the book Got Game.
Chris Anderson, I wonder though, you know, I can just hear the voices of many listening and thinking, shouldn't these kids be out climbing trees or, I don't know, getting sunshine and wind and out on the earth and not on a screen?
Yeah, well, the way we treat it with our own kids is we see games as a sort of a step up from television. So in other words, if they're going to spend time in front of a screen, we'd rather that our kids be interacting with the screen, and that's fine. Not a substitute for being outside and playing around. And, you know, frankly, our kids don't want to watch television anymore. If they'd much rather play a game, they'd much rather interact with it. And so it's not a challenge to keep them from one to the, you know, to move them from one to the other.
So there's the new hierarchy. Get off the TV, onto the game. Barbara's calling from Maquonago, Wisconsin. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Say, I just really like this conversation. It's very interesting, and I have a 14-year-old son that seems very addicted to the PC games, and right now it's Battle for Middle Earth.
How many hours a day, Barbara?
I would say he tries to squeeze in, you know, probably 2 hours a day.
So that's the real deal. I've heard worse, or I've heard longer, but that's a lot.
That's on a school day.
Wow.
But I try and justify it by saying, you know, it's strategy and he's thinking and it's better than watching TV.
But when you hear all of this laid out, all these advantages, the character of this generation, what it's going to be, do you buy it? Are you confident that that's what your son's getting from his hours on the battle game?
Well, you know, that's part of the reason I called in. I don't know. What limits do I put on him? You know, do I put limits on him? You know, he also plays basketball, and he is active in other ways, and he's not overweight, and he's a great student. So,
right.
You know, he loves it.
So how much is enough, or how much is too much, or how much do you need? John Beck, talk to Barbara. What's your advice?
If it's getting in the way of things, then limit them. If it's not getting in the way of what's going on in the rest of their life, and that's the way they choose to spend their free time, instead of, you know, reading books or watching TV or, you know, teasing the cat, you know, that's fine, I believe. So if it's getting in the way of the things they should be doing, like schoolwork or getting outside and getting some exercise, yeah, it's a problem. But otherwise, let them play.
Barbara, do you feel that your child, I guess your son, you said, is withdrawn after those couple of hours away in video game land? Or is he snap out of it and there's your boy?
I don't think so. It doesn't seem to be doing him any harm. In fact, you know, he seems to be, you know, well adjusted socially. You know, he's not a real talkative, outgoing child, but you know, he really seems to have almost a deeper understanding of things than I would expect for a child his age.
Well, if John Beck has got it right, you may be breeding a world beater there. Barbara, good luck with it, and thanks for your call. Chris Anderson, step back with us here for a second. You know, these games become more and more sophisticated, but there's all kinds of sophistication in this life. I mean, there's the way the lost feather of a bird looks close up. Do we lose as much as we gain when kids pick up all this new gaming experience?
I think the biggest change right now is that games are becoming community, activities that
online.
I mean, it's easy to focus on the graphics, and the graphics are amazing. And to your point, they are not as amazing as the real world. So one should not confuse it with getting out in the woods.
Yep.
I think the really important thing that's happening in games right now is the online multiplayer aspect.
Mm-hmm.
That increasingly these are becoming a legitimate social circle that you're having not just communications with the machine or communications with the artificial intelligence of the software, but communications with other real people around a kind of a shared activity. And this is becoming, you know, a way to kind of build teams, a way to work with other people, a way to kind of, you know, give and take and to be aggressive, you know, where in an appropriate setting. And I think that has taken gaming from a solitary activity to a social activity and probably actually helps the kids get confidence and learn to talk to others in a way that's successful.
Out of the isolation chamber and into a kind of community, plus everything John Beck is describing here. Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine. Wonderful to have you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us from San Francisco.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
We're talking about the video game generation and a new celebration of its game-generated life skills. What do you think? What about the downside? Was that just boomer ignorance? Can you see a new character in Americans under 35, a character shaped by gaming? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the video game generation and a new celebration of its game-generated life skills. My guest is John Beck, co-author of Got Game, How the Gamer Generation is Reshaping Business Forever. What do you think? Might the secret of success flow from an Xbox? And what about the game board of life? 1-800-423-8255. Darius is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Darius. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
So I have my 5-year-old in bed and my 6-week-old that I'm holding right now. So I'm really interested in this, and I'm a bit concerned in the sense that you're talking about success and how it relates to the people that play these games, but I feel like the success that is being talked about is, you know, a monetary business success.
Right. Go out, make the deal, compete, persevere.
Right. And it's utterly American to think in those terms. You know, is that the only measure of success? In other words, are these people that are holed up in their rooms? And when you walk around New York City, you see the flickering lights.
Yep.
It's not, I think the majority of that is games.
And what are you afraid is missing there, Darius?
Well, you know those people in those rooms are missing things. They are getting a game, but they're missing an interaction. So what I'm wondering is, these people that play two, three, whatever hours a day, how are they in marriages? How are they in friendships? How are they in relationships? Are they successful partners, lovers, whatever? And that's really, as a parent, more interesting to me and more important to me than are they going to make, you know,
a bundle.
Figures.
What ultimately really matters. That's a great expanding of the game board of this conversation, Darius. We thank you for it. John Beck, how about it?
Yeah, sure. Darius, I think that the only way I can really answer this from our survey is we ask questions about how people felt about other people in the workplace. So from the survey, we found that gamers actually were more likely to say, it's important for me to be accepted and appreciated by coworkers. I find people more stimulating than anything else. I prefer working with others to working alone.
And the gamers answered in higher percentages positively to these questions.
All of those questions.
But at an instinctive, intuitive level, don't you? I mean, I know Chris Anderson says community gaming is much bigger, but you know, a lot of it is still solitary.
It is. A lot of it is for
so
one person.
So come on,
If you go out and watch the way most kids play games these days, they play it with in combination with other kids. Mm-hmm. So if you're really looking at that 5 to 15-year-old period, they're playing with their siblings. When friends come over, they all get in front of the game and play it.
So not
they
a
pass
substitute.
The controller around. They know which kids are good at which parts of the game, and they say, you take it over now. You're good at this.
Would you rather marry a gamer?
Oh, if I were a game generation, absolutely.
Why?
Because I think that they're part of that generation. I don't think they're kind of that 10% that isn't playing right now that really doesn't kind of get the generation around them.
The new Amish.
Yeah.
So, Darius, it's a great question, though. Don't put the joystick in that six-week-old's hand just too early. Jeff is calling from Boston. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi.
Well,
I'm a Gen Xer who's definitely – I've been playing video games since I was 8 or 9.
Okay.
I've also had – close professional and social contacts with MIT undergrads for the last 20 years.
What do you see?
And, well, I don't disagree about the cooperative and social elements that gaming encourages, the gaming culture, but I do have a problem with the supposition that the video game culture is enhancing creativity in young people.
You don't see the evidence? You don't find it?
No, I do not. I find that those young people, and here I'm talking about my close daily and weekly contact with MIT undergrads, who are supposedly, you know, best of the best in terms of creativity. I find that those that are most engaged with video games recreationally spend a lot less time creating their own projects, and they tend to talk in the shorthand of whatever game vernacular is currently hot.
And they want to click into the game world rather than creating their own.
Yes, I'm afraid so. And like I said, cooperative socially, I agree with what your guest is saying. It is true.
But creativity, watch out. Jeff, if I may, let me ask you, I don't know how MIT stacks up in gender ratio these days, but what about the gender issue? I think most people associate gaming with boys or young men.
No, not so much anymore. Definitely when I was growing up, it was definitely primarily a boyhood pursuit.
You have young women sitting around playing Grand Theft Auto and, I don't know, shoot 'em up Hell on Earth or whatever it is?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And it appeals to the competitive nature. It allows, actually, the young men and women to interact in a way which is not, you know, it allows that natural competition to be expressed without being threatening. No, I actually think there's a lot of young women, at least at MIT, who are into gaming.
But you raise this issue of collective action versus creativity, and it's a great one. How about it, John Beck? The creativity side, what's the case you make?
Again, I'm not sure what it is for 25-year-olds or 20-year-olds in college, but certainly those 5 to 15-year-olds are getting a much more creative experience than the ones I had growing up.
Now why? The game is handed to them. It's all prepackaged.
But it is all about exploration and trying every possible angle on everything. Now,
That's kind of trial and error creativity.
It's trial and error creativity.
And you say gamers are much more likely to bounce back from failure because you fail all the time in games and you learn that's all right. Just get up and go again.
It's the only way to learn. It's the only way to succeed.
But what about breakthrough creativity? Something that, you know, nobody else has programmed for you, that you're going to come up with yourself entirely.
I guess that we'll find out, won't we, as this generation matures, and we'll see if they have the kind of breakthroughs that the generations before them did.
We will find out. And on the gender front, I asked Jeff about it, but what do you say? Are girls left out of this?
You know, we went back and thought we didn't do the, we didn't control for gender at one point after we got all excited about this first.
Uh-huh.
Then we went back and controlled for gender, and everything came out exactly the same.
But what percentage of gamers in this 5-15 group, let's say, are female?
Yeah, that's the key, is the 5-15, you get about a 45-55% split. Males are slightly ahead of females playing in that.
Same kind of games, or do you know?
At the younger ages, they're almost exactly the same kinds of games. You start to get a slight difference from kind of 12 on.
Well, we're gonna reserve final judgment, but the proof's already in the pudding and going to be more and more there. You've given us a lot to think about, John Beck. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Good. Thank you very much.
John Beck, co-author of the new book, Got Game, How the Gamer Generation is Reshaping Business Forever. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
When Mike is confirmed by the Senate, the Department of Homeland Security will be led by a practical organizer, a skilled manager, and a brilliant thinker.
The physical search has essentially ended, yes, but they continue to go through documents, so some of their work continues because there are thousands and thousands of pages of documents that they were able to recover.
We have detained individuals we believe are directly linked to the murder of the governor.
There is a group of senior people who are supposed to look at the segments and decide that they are appropriate, that they fit the standards of CBS. And that process in this case was seriously flawed.
In the past few days, we have seen the power of nature cause damage and despair. But we will match that power with our own resolve, and we will come together as Californians and as neighbors.
I have been saying for some time that my goal for this industry is zero tolerance regarding steroids. The agreement is an important step towards achieving that goal.
We have Hamas and Al-Aqsa competing to take the credit for closing it down. I think for Abu Mazen, the choice is clearer than it's ever been before. Is he going to help the terrorists, or is he going to help the Palestinian people?
I will faithfully discharge
the duties of governor.
The duties of governor.
Of the state of Washington.
Of the state of Washington.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability, so help me God. Thank you, Chief.
And there's a week. President Bush nominates former head of John Ashcroft's criminal division, Michael Chertoff, as the new Secretary of Homeland Security. The White House acknowledges that it has abandoned its search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Another violent week in Iraq as the elections loom there. Among the casualties this week, the governor of Baghdad. An in-house report chastises CBS for a story last fall about President Bush's Air National Guard service that relied on questionable documents. Mudslides in California kill at least 10 and destroy more than a dozen homes. Major League Baseball introduces a stricter new steroid testing policy. Mahmoud Abbas Abu Mazen easily wins the Palestinian elections, but Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today severed ties with the Palestinian Authority after a terrorist attack at a Gaza checkpoint. And Christine Gregoire is sworn in as governor of Washington State after several recounts and lawsuits. Her final margin of victory, 129 votes out of 2.9 million ballots cast. And that's a week. Jack Beatty, behind it all, you've been paying some attention to the economy.
Yes, and specifically to the trade gap. We set a record in November, a $60 billion trade deficit. Senator Byron Dorgan, the Democrat of North Dakota, said a trade deficit of $60 billion a month is a crisis, and it needs to be addressed not ignored. It's not really clear. It's not really clear what it would mean to be addressed. But its dimensions are really extraordinary. Last year, our exports of scrap and waste material were up 135%, but our exports of advanced technology products were down 21%.
Ouch.
We ran a $6 billion deficit in those fields, advanced technology products, in that November number. And 2004 was the first year in a generation that the United States ran a trade deficit in agricultural products.
Of course, what we hear, Jack, is the White House and others saying those other countries out there just aren't consuming enough.
That's what they say, and maybe they'll start to as our dollar comes down, maybe they'll start to buy more of our stuff. But the fact is, this trade deficit is taking place against the background of a falling dollar. So you'd think they had plenty of incentive. And, of course, other people think, no, the problems are much deeper. They go to our competitiveness and also to the financial vulnerability that we have with our budget deficit ever rising. And the dimensions that deficit could take on were brought home to me this week in a Paul Krugman column, who cited figures from the Congressional Budget Office, which point out that, yes, it would take $1 or 2 trillion to cover the transition costs this decade.
You're talking about Social Security, private accounts are introduced, yeah.
And it would take $3 trillion in the second decade, $5 trillion in the next decade, and another $5 trillion after that. In other words, over the next 30 years, it would add $15 trillion to the deficit.
Of course, President Bush says we can't just sit here and do nothing. We got a problem out there.
Well, of course, everybody points that out, that the problem is much less than what he is saying. And it was also a shock to me that the White House claimed that there's a $10 trillion threat to Social Security, that is the projection of Social Security's finances over infinity. I don't know that I'm going to live as long as infinity.
Somebody will. We hope. We dream.
Yeah. If I might, this talk about the economy, Robert Heilbronner died this week at 85.
Yes, right.
His classic book, The Worldly Philosophers, is the second best-selling book in economics next to Paul Samuelson's 7 editions. And he spent his life with the great thinkers, what really comes out of him is this picture he wrote in one of his last books, that they all were pessimistic about capitalism. The saturation of demand and the degradation of the labor force are the great difficulties of Smith's conception, leading him to be very pessimistic. The crises and contradictions in Marx's models, the inability to reach full employment that Keynes selected as the great flaw, and the cultural erosion that Joseph Schumpeter saw as arising out of capitalism. It's really quite extraordinary, isn't it, that the great economists, the people who founded the theory of capitalism, should have been so downbeat about its future.
And yet it sure appears to have whooped socialism pretty soundly.
Yes, it has. It certainly has. Certainly state-run socialism. Of course, others would say democratic socialism was never given a chance.
And it must look pretty good to China right now. It's working pretty well for them.
It's working pretty well for them. They're making progress with it, but of course, its problems now are that its own development is creating problems that it is not alone able to solve. The private sector can't solve. For example, bumping into the limits of growth on the population, and that's the kind of thing that made the worldly philosophers pessimistic.
I guess it's all where you stand. We had Milton Friedman, of course, recently. He says it's endlessly adaptive. You try and control this with the mind of man, and it doesn't work. It comes down to some pretty basic understandings of human nature and the way they interact.
It does indeed. And these people weren't, necessarily radical, certainly not Adam Smith or Keynes. But it's interesting that they were so brooding about this great and challenging economy we live in.
Jack, you give us something to brood about this weekend. Thanks for being with us. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Rachel Dornhelm, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skoog and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.